Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Steven Siegel, here today on New Books in German Studies and New Books Urban and New Books History with my guest, Professor Kristin Poling. Thanks, Kristin, for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So a little bit about our historian and author today. Dr. Kristin Poling is Assistant Professor of History at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, where she teaches modern European and global history and received the 2021 Distinguished Teaching Award. Her research spans the urban and environmental histories of Germany and the United States, including recent projects on German-American forestry in Michigan and working-class uses of nature on the periphery of Imperial Berlin. We'll be talking today about her new book called Germany's Urban Frontiers, Nature and History on the Edge of the 19th Century City, published with University of Pittsburgh Press 2020. So I want to start right away with my lineup of questions, and I always love to ask historians with their first books, what motivated you? What brought you to this topic?
Yeah, thank you. I love answering this question because it was a kind of long, twisty path that got me to this topic. Because my interest actually began with my fascination with the Berlin Wall in the 1980s. And kind of the Berlin Wall was, for I think many people in my generation, this kind of this image, this metaphor that kind of ruled over my young childhood. And in graduate school, one of my first research projects was on highway revolts in West Berlin in the 1980s. And I just became really interested in how borders and physical borders shaped other discourses over space and nature and environment in the city, and how the Berlin Wall, which was this quintessentially kind of unnatural concrete structure, became a space for what we might today call, you know, like guerrilla gardening and these other kind of unusual uses of space and room for nature and spontaneity in the city. And it was actually kind of the apparent anachronism of the wall that provided space for other kinds of protest. So I was looking into how Berliners use the wall to tell different kinds of stories about place and history. And I discovered a fact well known to historians of Berlin, but really surprising to me at the time, which was that the 20th century Berlin Wall overlapped for a stretch with the historical 19th century Berlin tax wall. And this was a fact that was not unnoted by Berliners at the time, right? So you see, especially in East Berlin, people say, well, of course there's a wall here, right? Like there was always a wall here. This is a natural border. And this got me thinking about these sort of spatial echoes through time and kind of sent me to the city archives and the newspaper archives to discover what I could find about the 19th century Berlin Wall that had been taken down. And then kind of by happenstance, I sort of discovered these surprising echoes that, you know, weren't a story in themselves, but kind of got me hooked looking at borders in the 19th century.
Yeah, I mean, I think about Berlin a lot, Kristin, and I kind of wonder what led you first to Berlin and then to choose the other cities. Mm-hmm. So would you mind telling our listeners and readers of your book what cities you chose and why?
Yeah, sure. So I think one of the things that I found really fascinating about Berlin to start with, as someone who grew up in the American Midwest, was the way it kind of wears its history and its changing past kind of out in the open, right? So I grew up in these landscapes of the American Midwest where history is kind of erased, right? Like we build infrastructure and then we tear it down again, right? And it's very hard to read the history of a space, of a city into its landscape. And so Berlin and, you know, a lot of Central European cities kind of wear their historical kind of processes of change out in the open. So I started looking at Berlin. That was kind of my starting point. And then I circled out. I wanted to tell a story that allowed me to get at lots of different themes and the kind of variety of experiences of urban space in 19th century Germany. So I started by looking for kind of different kinds of cities. I wanted a city that had an identity primarily as a market city, which took me eventually to the city of Leipzig, where I did a lot of my research. I wanted a city that was a sort of smaller state capital, which took me to the city of Oldenburg. I wanted cities that were in different kinds of environments, right? That were in forested environments, in river environments, in the bogs and marshes of Northwest Germany, and so on. So I wanted to look at regional variety. I wanted to look at a variety of sizes of cities. So I started with a much longer list, and I kind of narrowed it down by looking at, you know, what sources were available and how I was allowed or how I was able to kind of look at different themes through a selection of case studies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you find so many rich sources, I think, and I'm really grateful that there's a bibliography with your sources and files from, you know, from Paderborn as well, from the Landesarchiv in Nordrhein-Westfalen. Really just an incredible list of sources. Is there a book or set of books that inspired you to choose the topic? Was it secondary literature? I know you have David Blackburn a lot, but was there any sort of particular book or set of books that got you interested in this as a topic in German studies?
Yeah, let's see. I mean, I think some of the early starting points for my interest in this topic, I mean, I think really important for me was the work of absolute classic of Mack Walker, and not just his work on German hometowns, where what really fascinated me about his approach to space there was I think what he calls urban prosopography, where he does this kind of collective biography of different cities, and more so than his actual arguments, that kind of technique of prosopography for urban space, right, was really fascinating to me. And also really important for me was his other, I think, unfairly less read and remembered book on German migration and the way that the imagined collective experience of overseas immigration shaped German consciousness in the 19th century. So those two books together helped provide some of the structure for how I thought about this project. Though I ended up wanting to tell, I sort of started by envisioning my book as having a similar kind of prosopographical approach. And I ended up deciding that what was really interesting and what was important was how stories of urban growth were so just inextricably embedded in their local environments and circumstances. So I stayed more kind of grounded in my local case studies than say, Walker's approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I want to come back and ask you about some of your big arguments and takeaway points in the book. I love this idea of prosopography, you know, biographies of cities, which are not no places, but actual places, and everyone has a story. So what particularly strikes me is the early modern to modern transformation. I guess you could call it growth, but it's not exactly linear progress. Could you talk a little bit about this defortification notion? And I especially see this in the case of Leipzig. What does that mean? Like, what does it mean in Saxony? But what does it mean for any German city? How did that take place?
Yeah. So generally, you know, so I look at the process by which cities lost their built and visible borders. And usually the first step of this for Central European cities was the removal of what had been military fortifications, at least over a certain size. So these were not just walls, but also moats and ramparts that surrounded cities. And often began to be neglected early in the 18th century as they became more obsolete as military defenses, but also just kind of too expensive to maintain. Mm-hmm. And then this was a new kind of space on the edge of the city, these kind of semi-neglected walls and ramparts and moats, which were often turned over to other uses, to housing, to craft workshop, or to market use, and so on. And then plans for how to use those spaces or transform them differed in their timing and their use by city. In Leipzig, as in many cities, spaces along old fortifications were first they were first used for promenades, for green spaces. They were turned over to recreational space and then later filled in or eliminated. This is usually, I find, kind of what people think of when they think of removing the city wall, was the defortification of the city, right? Because these were big walls, big structures that created really lasting traces in the, you know, street plans, the layouts of the city. But when city fortifications removed, that didn't mean we were left with an open city, right? So when Leipzig took down its fortifications, it still had a city wall. It still closed its gates at night. Leipzigers still thought of the city as a closed space where they could identify its boundary. And one of the things I really wanted to do was to investigate that transitional time, right? After city fortifications were taken down, but before the city had lost its sort of boundedness as a space, before, say, Leipzigers had lost touch with the idea that they should be able to see and know where the edge of their city was. And this was a time when there were, you know, things like tax walls, tax boundaries, and other kinds of boundaries, which we've largely forgotten because they didn't leave the same kinds of traces in the urban landscape, the streetscape, that fortifications did.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, you know, since this is such a classic German theme of Grenzen and borders, that the working idea of really the frontier, how do you translate it? You know, is it open? Is it closed? Is the line dotted or bold or invisible? And I love, you know, how you play in many ways with the flexibility of this meaning. Could you possibly give us maybe your understanding? I'm sorry to pin this down, but what would be your working understanding of Grenzen, of borders? Did you have an idea of how you were going to approach this in writing your five chapters?
Yeah, so part of, I think, my method was to look at different kinds of borders and to see them as connected through the eyes of my primary source authors. That is, not to treat, say, fortifications as separate from the financial or tax boundaries of the city, as separate from the administrative boundaries of the city, but to see them as connected because that's how people saw them at the time, right? And what I found is that the idea of a kind of border of the city has been, you know, kind of dissolved by its importance across different subfields, right? So we think about, say, the fortifications of the city or the tax border of the city or the administrative boundaries or infrastructural boundaries of the city. And these are all treated in kind of different ways. And they disappeared and changed at different rates and through different processes. But 19th century German urbanites, you know, saw echoes of the fortifications when they thought about infrastructural changes to the border of the city, even 50 years after the walls had disappeared, right? So my concept of the border of the city was really to look at these different kinds of spatial boundaries together with each other, because I thought that reflected the experience of the city in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. And do you find it different by regions and how? I guess this is kind of an innocent question, but for those who are not specialists in German history, how do you find, let's say, the sight or the vision or even kind of panoramic vision of city officials differing between Prussia, Saxony, Westphalia? I guess there are many other examples you could sort of multiply with this, but since you did spend a lot of time with a kind of deep dive into city archives, I'm wondering if you could describe that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this was one of the most interesting things, I think, that I didn't necessarily know I was going to find, but that developed over the course of my research. And that is, I started with these kinds of sources that I expected to be more similar across cities, right? So I started not knowing much, going to an archive in, you know, Oldenburg or Leipzig, and just looking for the document series on city gates, on the removal of the city wall, on the decisions to open the city gates. And I started kind of reading through and looking at the language that city officials used to talk about the city border and these decisions about, you know, like when in Oldenburg was the right time to eliminate the nightly closure of the city gates. And what I found is that, these highly kind of practical and local decisions were framed by these really kind of abstract concerns, right? So city officials in Oldenburg, when they decide to open their city gates, the decision largely revolves around questions of what does it mean to be modern? How do we make it clear that Oldenburg has become a modern city over the last centuries, right? Well, we want to heighten this contrast between the medieval fortified city and modern open Oldenburg. So we are going to open our gates. Right. And it's about establishing a modern identity for the city. Another kind of really interesting thing I found is the ways in which local landscapes really shaped the language used and the kind of structures used to understand the growth of the city as well. So to take the example of Oldenburg again, which, you know, is in this landscape of marsh and moorland in northwestern Germany, language of water control, of diking, of canalization, right? These are the metaphors that are used to understand the borders of the city, right? The borders of the city are actually kind of imbricated into these regional landscapes of water control. Similarly, in Berlin, right, the language is really that of what is the relationship between the capital and, first Prussia and then the German Empire, right? And sort of thinking about the suburban landscape of Berlin as analogous to the broader frontier of the German Empire, right? So these the sort of images and metaphors used to understand the expansion of the city down to these very workaday city council documents, right?
Yeah.
It is kind of in there. It kind of came out of my sources.
I had some questions for you about those.
Yeah.
We can talk taxes, I guess, and reports, because, you know, you're mentioning canals and wetlands, and I think about the differences between cities mostly enclosed by walls. You know, like Bielefeld would be a good example of this, right? Mostly enclosed. And then there's wetlands and wet moats, and you kind of have to work through it and around it. You know, could you say a few words maybe about the tone, first of all, and then kind of like the actual content for these planners and developers from the 1840s onward? I mean, what were some examples or maybe even some individual cases that struck you?
Yeah, so some individual case of people who are talking about or working on the expansion of the city and the kinds of ways they talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. So let's see. I guess the first thing that comes in to mind is again, from Oldenburg, and to look at, for example, how also questions of immigration and overseas migration really shaped decisions about expanding the city. So there were these, reformers like Ludwig Starkloff, a kind of bureaucrat who advocated, he was kind of a passionate advocate for canalization as part of the modernization of both the city and the kind of broader landscape of Oldenburg, or people like Otto Lazius, who thought that the modernization of the Oldenburg was going to compete to sort of keep people from migrating abroad, right? Like, you really saw an expanded Oldenburg as in kind of competition as a space with overseas spaces that might otherwise draw Germans away.
Yeah, and I guess this was my question about taxes, just to be more specific, because, there is a kind of liberal moment, correct me if I'm wrong, but in a lot of the journals that you see in Prussia and maybe Westphalia, there's the Zollverein, right? The customs union with it begins in 1834. I mean, can you give us a kind of comparison contrast with some of your cities on how, the impact of these taxes, what were they? What was the Prussian tax code? How did people challenge it? What were the revisions to it?
Yeah, sure. So there were these taxes that were exacted at the city border on meat and grain, which played a really big role, actually, in defining the edge of the city, especially kind of from the 1820s up through the 1840s for a lot of cities, and then even into the 1860s and 70s for other cities. This was really a tax that was founded on the idea that urban and rural spaces were different kinds of spaces of production, right? So these were taxes exacted on any grain or meat or heads of cattle that entered the city. And they were perceived as being kind of anachronistic from the very beginning, and were a target of protest throughout Prussia in the 1840s, and in cities selectively, individually were exempted from those taxes one by one. So I look at the case of Paderborn in my book, for example. There were a few very large cities that kept these taxes up through the 1860s, and Berlin is an example of this. So the tax on grain and meat was preserved until the 1860s in Berlin, and this became increasingly, it seemed, sort of out of step with the very character of a metropolis. It was also impractical. It meant you had a lot of kind of stink and mess at gates, and traffic. And so it became a kind of symbol of backwardness, of the overreaching of Prussian administrative power into the city. There are a number of these kind of pamphlets and, written against the taxes in the 1860s.
Uh-huh. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like
filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really persuaded by that, Kristen. And I love the chapter that you have, Taxing the Urban Border, because I think it made me think about, at least in reflecting on urban borders and where they end and where they begin, on what taxes at city gates mean, right? So if you've got, you know, if you've got a customs union, at least theoretically, it I guess should be open, but you know, 1848 comes along, and then you know there are some major changes. I guess, you know, if you could talk a little bit about what it means for the building and then destruction of walls, like the decaying walls, the fortifications, even some of the wetlands and moats that are still there. Is there a sort of major like turning point? I'm not going into the Zondervag direction, but is there a turning point that happens in the mindset for a lot of your planners and builders and ultimately boosters in these, you know, sort of worlds of growth?
Yeah, so this is really interesting because I think what happens in the discussion in the 1840s is that the city wall and the city gate in particular becomes kind of metaphorically connected with all these other kinds of boundaries, and in a way with questions also of German unification. So you see this language where, you know, you have the kind of old-fashioned, usually bumbling, often drunk in the kind of cartoonish version, right? Gatekeeper, right? Who's standing there, ineffective, but trying to stand in the way of progress, which is represented by German unification and by the railroad, right? So you've got gatekeeper versus the railroad. And what this actually does, and this is a really powerful image, and you see it a lot in the 1840s. However, it really overstates the significance of the tax wall, and it demonstrates how important the wall is as a metaphor rather than as an actual spatial boundary. So if we take the example of Paderborn, which I look at in you know, a relatively small city in that chapter on taxing the urban border, you know, the train station is built far outside of the historic center of the city, outside of the of where the wall actually is. The wall itself is not particularly wide. It's not a very cumbersome structure. When people want to get through it, you know, they just kind of knock holes in it, right? Like it's not really a big deal. You know, they kind of, you know, it's already crumbling. They just kind of pick their way through, right? It's not actually that important a physical structure, but when looked at in the context of the growth of Prussian power, the intervention of Prussian power into local cities and affairs, these questions of modernization, right? Is Paderborn a growing city? Paderborn, this tiny little place, but does it also participate in urban modernity? Or is it this kind of backwater, right? These big questions give this rather insignificant physical structure a new kind of significance that brings these big questions to local environments, especially sort of from the 1840s through the, you know, Paderborn, the 1880s, when the wall finally mostly kind of comes down.
Yeah, I mean, Paderborn is such a great example. I mean, I love the example of this because so many things happen there, given its scale and its size. You've got the cholera epidemic. You have a kind of mentality, or maybe even a stereotype of Paderborn as a site for democracy, or at least tending toward democracy. And I guess, you know, that leads me to the bigger questions I would ask of any European historian in the mid 19th century, which is about the kind of Haussmannization projects and maybe in some ways the reduction of this conquest of nature idea to rationalization and modernity. I mean, how do you see this working out, especially because you're paying attention to environment and landscape and freedom of movement, relatively speaking, you know, going in, going out of the city? Do you see these rationalization projects as very top down to the point where they're eliminating people from participating in housing or participating in the sort of tax base to the city? I mean, how do you begin to read that through your sources?
Yeah, this is really, and this is a topic I found really fascinating in looking at these maybe cities that are a little less studied, like Oldenburg or Paderborn, which is the way you see these echoes of, say, Haussmannization in Paris or the construction of the Ringstrasse in Vienna, right? And these questions of, well, can Oldenburg have a grand ring boulevard like Vienna does? Can we have Haussmannization in Oldenburg, right? So city planners and developers do think in those terms, right? They compare even smaller and regional cities and capitals to Europe's great capitals as well. However, as your question kind of implies, it's a lot more kind of complex, right? It never really works out that clearly. And what happens right away is that these schemes come into contact with the kind of local peculiarities and histories and characters of those cities, right? So in Oldenburg, this question of what does it look like to have a rationally planned city when you have all of these natural limits on the growth of your city, right? So, you know, expanding the city becomes also a project of moorland reclamation, which shapes the outline of the city, for example.
I mean, I'm wondering, Kristen, if these city planners, and we have this great chapter on shanty towns as well, and I wanted to ask you more about that. If the city planners had an idea of what the ideal population should be, right? Because we're still dealing with scale. Not every German city is going to surpass its provincialism, in both in terms of space and in terms of people, not less, you know, infrastructure as well. So, I mean, did you find in digging through the city archives that they had an idea of how far particular cities should build, should expand themselves outward?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, there were different visions. I mean, one of the advantages, I think, of looking, really focusing on this moment in the mid-19th century is that, there was already such dramatic urban growth in so many cities throughout Germany, but at the same time, it wasn't yet clear to a lot of observers at the time what the kind of outlines of the modern city would look like. So there were different visions for what the future city, what shape the future city would take. And there were also anxieties about out of control growth, about a city that had grown too large. And it's definitely true in Berlin, where you have on the one hand these kind of euphoric boosterist visions of a Berlin which grows to encompass all of Germany, right? Where the suburbs of Berlin merge with the suburbs of Dresden, and, you know, urban growth becomes tantamount with national unification, right? So that vision is one side of it, but the other side of it is anxiety about a Berlin that grows too much and that also sees that growth as tantamount to losing what makes Germany distinct, which is its landscape of many small and independent towns. And this, you know, this conflict, which is really over the nature of the empire and about the federal nature of the German empire, also plays a role in conversations over urban planning and Berlin's growth in the 1860s and 70s.
Were there particular individuals, and by that I mean planners or mappers, you know, who saw shanty towns as desirable or undesirable? I mean, who were your people, I guess? And I think here, you know, lasting contrast through the 19th century, like the Saxon conservatives who don't want Leipzig or Dresden to be Berlin because it's Saxony, right? I mean, who are these people, I guess? What sort of, you know, roles did they play? You've got officials, you have art historians, you know, you have a lot of others who I might be described as activists, economists. Where do they see this, the line or the shantytown frontier, as you described so well?
Yeah, I mean, and in Berlin, right, so there were, you know, after the foundation of the German Empire in 1871, there was this extraordinary rapid growth and housing crisis in Berlin that created these kind of boomtown shanty towns around the edge of the city. And these shanty towns were interpreted by observers either as a kind of housing crisis and a moral crisis for Berlin and for Germany, or as evidence of the kind of health and vibrancy of German economy, and sort of seen analogous to the American frontier, right? That Germany kind of had its own urban frontier spaces. And these, you know, working class Berliners who were, you know, sort of casting aside the restrictiveness and the dankness of Berlin apartment buildings to go out on the edge of the city and build their own shanties with their own two hands, right? And plant their gardens, right? These were like Germany's kind of young pioneers.
Wild gardening is how you describe it, I think. And I see this in Berlin today, but in a very different context.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, so there's this whole literature of, and you know, these are the kinds of sources that you always have to read with a grain of salt, but it's kind of interesting that these articles are there nonetheless, right? In 1872, especially, there's this kind of burst of magazine and newspaper coverage in kind of, you know, middle-class illustrated magazines that really mythologize these shanty towns on the edge of Berlin as these frontier spaces. And one of my arguments, right, is that the kind of middle-class urbanites who would have been reading these magazines like Gartenlaube and so on, they would have been very familiar with frontier literature, with the kind of coverage of the American West, say, and German pioneers all over the world, German immigrants all over the world, that they would have also read in the pages of the same magazines. This was a real attempt to kind of mythologize Berlin's urban growth and to place it in the same kind of geographic landscape as, you know, the, say, American frontier. You know, that was obviously a problematic romanticization. It meant pasting over, in many cases, the, you know, the real want that these spaces evidenced, and the fact that there really was no adequate housing in Berlin, but I think reflects a real thirst in this population of especially urban boosters and reformers. You know, people, you asked for people, right? So people like Julius Faucher, who was a prominent kind of housing reformer and economist, who was really celebrated. He was the one who anticipated that one day Berlin's suburbs would be indistinguishable from Dresden's, right? So he was one of these housing reformers really celebrated urban growth in that way.
Yeah, I love, you know, also how you connect in the chapter called The Shanty Town Frontier, which, you know, is based on an article you wrote too, with the German settler diaspora. I'm absolutely fascinated by this, you know, having been a person obsessed with maps and cartography and the Bürgertum, you know, sort of bürgerliche mentality. Could you say a few words about what the connection is between, let's say, German colonial settlement, migration, and of course, the frontier spaces that become replicated in the United States? Is it just in New York? I mean, are these sort of like, you know, ideas for German Midwestern settlement that you see in parallel or reflected by the mid to late 19th century, you know, sort of aspirational migrant class, for lack of a better word? How do you see that sort of history of German colonialism and especially German settler colonialism spread in the global context?
Yeah, this is really interesting that there are these sort of common, spatial patterns which connect the German global diaspora with German urban growth at home, right? There are these kind of common structures and ideas about space, about the German attachment to gardens, for example, that connect German diaspora settlements with, the edges of German cities back in the German Empire. And what I found, and I think this is probably a more familiar story, right, is that the sort of imagining of that German settler experience overseas really shaped how Germans saw the space of their own cities. And mm-hmm. this can be seen in really direct ways, like the fact that shanty towns and other urban peripheral settlements were frequently called things like Little America in kind of popular saying. And this was also true of the colonial landscape as well, right? So there were also cities all over Germany in the 1880s with especially working class neighborhoods on the urban edge that were referred to as New Cameroons or Little Cameroons, right? So there were these global geographies that were reflected back in on the urban landscape throughout Germany. But I do think one important thing to distinguish here is that I think often when it comes to understanding the experience of cities like Berlin or Leipzig or Oldenburg or the German cities, is that it often was kind of imagined experiences of German migration mediated by magazine literature or by popular fiction and not actual experiences of German migration. Yeah. Although there were also these connections, through letter writing and other things between communities.
I'm sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you, but I wanted to ask you about that because I'm wondering what they're reading. I think of Karl May and I think of Freytag and others, but for your audience, for those who are sort of expanding beyond the urban frontier, and it might include migration, is it popular, sort of like magazines? Is it an idea of America or of African settlement or whatever? How does that factor into your idea of the moral and sort of economic frontier zone? Was that something that you were looking for as you were exploring sources in these cities and towns?
Yeah, this came up especially in Berlin, where I saw particularly in descriptions and coverage of the shanty towns that there were actually explicit references to popular fiction about the American frontier and especially the Gold Rush, right? So there were references to Gold Rush novels in the descriptions of the shanty towns. So that was a case where it was really explicit. In other cases, there was, popular travel literature played some role. So travel descriptions, and not just of the Americas, but also in the German Northwest, there was this real fascination with the steppe and Russian landscapes as well. So there were, depending on where you were, it was different landscapes, but travel literature played a role as well. And then mm-hmm. I think, there were this sort of popular magazines, especially when it came to sort of Germany's colonies and later in the century. That's I think, this all provided a kind of set of images and reference points for understanding the place of German cities in a global landscape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you've got some of these frontier dramas I should mention for readers and novels about the Eastern Marches. I think Clara Wiebig is one of your examples. Could you explain that? I mean, for those readers who are not familiar with Die Furt den Toren, what is it? I mean, how do these sort of dramas, I guess I would call them melodramas, then factor into this idea of settling landscapes? I guess it's really a colonial mentality, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing I found really interesting is there are these novelists like Gustav Freytag and like Clara Wiebig, who are perhaps better known for their work on German settlement, sort of eastward expansion settlement in Polish areas, right? So both Wiebig and Freytag. But they also wrote books about sort of urban expansion and the kind of edge of the city. So Wiebig's 1910 novel, Those Outside the Gates, is really about Berlin's expansion and about what happens to a suburban settlement as it becomes kind of amalgamated into the city, and about the loss, you know, it becomes kind of synonymous with the loss of any sense of kind of moral boundaries. This also shows up in the novels of Theodor Fontana.
Sure.
You know, he kind of contemplates, you always have to pay lots of attention in Fontana novels to where in the city something happens, right? Because if it happens in the suburbs, it's probably a mistake, right? He's always, very aware of kind of where his characters are in relation to actually the city walls and gates, right? And he'll often narrate like the sort of exit and entry into the city, whether that's Berlin or whether it's Bremen and so on.
That's a great point. I didn't think of it that way, because it really is this moment of transgression, passing in, passing out. You know, it's a permeable frontier, I guess, but it's a moment of anxiety as you're describing it. I've got to ask you, because I know, you know, with all of the richness of this book, if you could say a few words about environmental history and German environmental history and maybe historiography. So, you know, I, as a person who studies maps, I think about gerrymandering as well as, you know, like preservation. What are some of the conservation, I should say, what are some of the bigger issues that maybe readers and listeners can tease out of your book for studying the German environmental past?
Yeah, so in the environmental themes in this book were themes that I didn't start with, right? I started looking at the urban border, and I found, right, that it was impossible to do that without considering questions of environment and nature. It just kept popping up in my sources and in the questions that I found myself confronting for each of my cities. And there were a couple different ways in which this came up that I think are really unique to studying the urban edge or the urban frontier. And one is the way in which ideas of nature and conservation really emerged alongside a kind of naturalization of the historical city. The way in which over the course of the 19th century, the historical city and its boundaries itself became subsumed in an idea of a natural landscape. Often urban preservation, historical preservation, and natural preservation emerged side by side in the German context. And this is something that has come out of the work of German environmental historians like Thomas Leakin, for example. I was really kind of interested in making sure that the stories of those landscapes, those distinctive environments, were part of the story of urban expansion as well. To see how the limits on historical the limits on the historical city were connected to these kind of distinctive local environments. I was thinking there also of the work of someone like Dorothea Brandts, who's looked at sort of the changed relationship, sort of complicating our understanding of the relationship between the city and nature and you know, not just looking at kind of parks and trees when we're thinking about nature in the city, but thinking about the ways in which, for example, infrastructure is embedded in the shape of infrastructure kind of connects the environmental conditions of a city with its built landscape and identity.
I'm interested in, I have to ask this of you as a German historian, if you could maybe say a few words about the connection between scholarship on German colonialism and imperialism. I know this is such a huge debate and it's impossible to answer in one sentence, but, you know, again, you know, toward the end of your book on in Urban Histories and National Futures, you have these very interesting passages talking about Cameroon and Tanzania and so forth, overseas colonies. And then as Kristin Kopp and others have done, speaking about, you know, Germanization in the East, Danzig, Dansk, Posen, Poznan, and so forth. So, you know, what do you see as your contribution to that debate with your book? I certainly see this in the defortification issue, but maybe without putting words in your mouth, what do you think our readers could get?
Yeah, so I think that urban expansion and the idea of defortification and urban growth became one available framework for understanding Germanization. And this is most clear, I think, in Posen Poznan, where you see very explicitly the language of urban progress linked to a language of Germanization. You know, I think there's been a lot of attention to kind of the rural in understanding those spatial colonial relationships and Germanization in the East, but that this was also a framework for urbanization. And you can see there how Germanization kind of discourses were connected to these broader, they were sort of given legitimacy by their connection to this broader understanding of urban progress, of urbanization, of modernizing the city. And again, in the case of Posen Poznan, these were kind of used very explicitly to justify Germanization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. And I mean, I know you mentioned Catherine Siancia's work on Polish history. So I think there's a lot more to be done in thinking about this as a civilization discourse or maybe even civilization mission from the 19th century in provincial regions on the scale of small towns and so forth. So I've got to ask, could you recommend maybe two or three other books, other authors? I know we've talked a lot and name dropped a lot, but others, you know, that you're reading or that you might be interested in contemporary work on urban history and landscape and German studies.
I'll mention the book I'm reading right now because I'm really enjoying it, which is Brian Ladd's new book, The Streets of Europe. And I really love it. So it in a way, it's sort of a survey of the 18th, 19th century European city, but seen very explicitly through the kind of built structures and imagining of Europe's streets. And I love it because of the way he connects kind of cultural history and physical environments in a way that I've also tried to do in some of my writing. And it's just a tremendously fun read. And it also offers this kind of gentle provocation against the temptation to romanticize cities of the past in a way that I really love. Let's see. And I guess also, if I could mention a book actually outside of European history, but which I've been thinking about a lot lately, which is Bathsheba Demut's Floating Coast, An Environmental History of the Bering Strait, which has just really changed how I think about constructing historical narratives and how she connects the perspectives of different species and thinks about the connection between different scales and of experience in both space and time. It's one of those books that's really made me step back and rethink how I think about sort of constructing historical narratives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bathsheba was one of my inspirations. It's one of the first podcast interviews I ever did.
So,
number two, maybe in 2019. It's such a brilliant book. Thank you for those references. I haven't read Brian Ladd, and I hope to do that. So the last question for you, Kristin Pauling, since we've been talking about built environments and Germany's urban frontiers, if you could talk about your current work or current projects, I think our listeners would love to hear that.
Yeah. So as I sort of like everybody else, I'm eagerly, anxiously awaiting for libraries and archives to open up a bit more. There are kind of two projects that I've been working on. And one is a project I've been thinking about for a really long time and finally kind of jumping into. And this is a project on the transatlantic history of the playground in German and American cities. And this is a project that it's kind of shocking that I don't think there is really a book that does this, but, you know, the sort of sociality and children, the way children move around cities is so different in Germany and the United States. As someone who's traveled with my children to German cities, is really evident to me. And yet there are actually all these connections between Germany and the United States in the history of playgrounds, whether it's from like the importation of the German Sandgarten from Berlin to Boston in the 1880s to the sort of transatlantic adventure playground movement. There are all these kind of projects and connections between the cultures of kind of urban space, nature, politics, and actually kind of wildness, in that children are always a little wild, right? And so they're uncontrollable in the city. So it gets at a lot of these themes about kind of transatlantic connections and urban space and nature and so on, but in a new kind of a new environment. So that's what I
never would have thought. I should think about it in terms of zoning and gerrymandering and inclusion and exclusion and cities. That's a brilliant idea. I wonder how, like, can I just ask a really quick follow-up? How would you do your Quellenkritik with that? I mean, what sources would you use for something like that?
So there are in both Germany and the United States, there are these associations, like playground associations. And then there are particular cities that play a particularly important role in the kind of origin of playgrounds. So Detroit, Boston, Berlin, Minneapolis, right? So, you know, there can be, and actually in a similar way, I guess, to my last book, there can be these kind of local stories about the emergence of, you know, decisions about playground planning. But then also there are these kind of national structures and organizations that advocate for reform and new understanding of urban space, like the Playground Association of America.
Sure. Yeah, bounded and unbounded frontiers, I think, right? Thank you so much, Kristen Pauling, for joining us. I have been talking here with author Kristen Pauling. Her new book is Germany's Urban Frontiers, Nature and History on the Edge of the 19th Century City, published by University of Pittsburgh Press, 2020. Here on New Books Network and the channels New Books German Studies, New Books History, New Books Urban. Kristen, thank you so much. This has been a great conversation, and I've really enjoyed having you on the podcast today.
Yes, thank you. This was wonderful. Thank you very much.
And I'm your host, Stephen Siegel. Until next time.